Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hallrock. First on this week's program, Kate Gallego says other cities need to step up to prevent heat deaths. The story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on October 29th. Phoenix officials touted this summer's heat mitigation efforts as a success. But after hundreds of people died of heat-related illness, officials acknowledged that one heat death is too many and admitted that the city's efforts weren't successful enough. To improve things, they say, other government agencies in Maricopa County and the state need to step up and help out. This progress was shared at a media event last week. We had a record-setting number of records this year when it came to our summer heat, said David Handula, the director of Phoenix's Office of Heat Response and Mitigation. I'm very confident that there's been a significant and positive public health impact from this work. Lives were saved and lives were changed. The summer was particularly brutal. Phoenix endured 70 days of 110-plus degree weather, smashing last year's record by 15 days, according to the National Weather Service. The Valley also saw 142 triple-digit degree days, which is only three shy of the record set in 2020. On Saturday, the city experienced its last 100-degree day, just 24 hours shy of the 2016 record for the final recorded 100-degree day of the season. Phoenix does not track the number of heat-related deaths that occur within city limits. That data is collected by Maricopa County. According to the county's heat dashboard, 40 fewer people have died from heat in Maricopa County this year compared with the same time last year. However, heat death totals remain high, and many heat deaths are still under investigation. So far this year, 429 people have died from heat-related illnesses, while another 241 deaths are being investigated for heat-related causes. Nearly half of those undetermined deaths were among unhoused people. In 2023, 645 people in the county died from heat, setting a record for the most heat-related deaths in a single year. According to a report shared by the city, Phoenix saw a notable 20% reduction in heat-related emergency calls this summer compared with last year. That reduction in calls stemmed from heat mitigation programs introduced this year, specifically increasing the availability of cooling centers and hydration supplies. "Frankly, I'm so proud of this report," said Assistant Phoenix Fire Chief Tim Kreis. Phoenix opened more cooling centers in 2024. Extending their hours later into the day and including an overnight center at Burton Barr Central Library. According to Rachel Milne, director of the city's Office of Homelessness Solutions, 92% of visitors to the enhanced sites with longer hours self-reported experiencing homelessness. Milne's office played a large role in heat response this year. The city reported that Homelessness Solutions navigators helped almost 900 individuals in Phoenix cooling centers access services, including housing, shelter treatment programs, safe outdoor spaces, and even reconnections with family. About 18% of those helped were parents and their minor children, and the city said Milne's office helped 92 kids find a place to sleep, access those resources, and the services they need to start ending their homelessness. The city also distributed 1 million water bottles and other hydration supplies to community members in need. Yet, as heat deaths remain high across the valley, Phoenix City officials called on other agencies and governmental bodies to provide much-needed assistance. Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego said the state's largest city feels it is doing the lion's share of the difficult work. "We can save more lives if more levels of government step up," Gallego said, adding that she hopes the state plays a bigger role in heat mitigation. Heat does not end at Phoenix municipal boundaries, so we need other cities to step up. In a related story, here's how Valley Rentals rank in the Southwest. Spoiler, not great. This story was written by Morgan Fisher and posted on October 31st. As rent remains high in Arizona, families looking to rent a single-family home will have trouble finding an affordable option in one Valley city. A new study from Rent-A-Meter shows that in the third quarter of 2024, families paid an average of $3,986 a month to rent a single-family home in Scottsdale. Not only is that a 9% increase from a year ago, but it's also the highest average rent price for a three-bedroom home in the entire Southwest. Scottsdale isn't alone in experiencing rent hikes, however. Flagstaff also made it into Rent-A-Meter's list of the top 10 cities in the region, with average rent prices ranking third. Flagstaff families pay an average of $3,048 a month for a three-bedroom home, up 7% from last year. Three other Arizona cities, Apache Junction, Tucson, and Marana, also saw 7% increases in single-family rent prices over last year. The rest of the cities in Rent-A-Meter's top 10 are in Texas and New Mexico, including Santa Fe at number 2, Dallas at number 5, and Austin at number 8. But renters in several other Arizona cities have seen notable cost increases in the last year. Single-family homes in Prescott and Tempe rent for about $2,700 a month, a slight increase for both municipalities. Prescott's rents increased 1%, and Tempe's jumped 4% from last year. While rents aren't as high and the location isn't as popular, Bullhead City also saw a significant 8% increase in rent prices compared with 2023. A single-bedroom home in Bullhead City, which borders Nevada and almost touches California, rents for almost $2,000 a month. Not every Arizona locale saw rent hikes, though. The study identified 7 Arizona cities that experienced rent decreases, even if only slight, from last year. Yuma saw a 6% decrease in rent prices for single-family homes, down to $1,664 a month on average. In the Valley, rent prices in Buckeye and Gilbert dipped 2%, while Sahuarita, Maricopa, Tolleson, and Lake Havasu City rents dropped by 1%. Here are the top 10 cities in Arizona with the highest average monthly rents for a single-family home. Number 1, Scottsdale, $3,986, up 9%. Number 2, Flagstaff, $3,048, up 7%. Number 3, Prescott, $2,693, up 1%. Number 4, Tempe, $2,650, up 4%. Number 5, Chandler, $2,519, up 3%. Number 6, Phoenix, $2,436, up 5%. Number 7, Gilbert, $2,388, down 2%. Number 8, Peoria, $2,361, no change. Number 9, Glendale, $2,330, up 6%. And number 10, Mesa, $2,317, up 1%. Rachel Mitchell's fiancé used burner accounts to attack her critics. The county attorney's beau copped in court to anonymously sniping at reporters and politicians who criticized Mitchell on X. This story was written by Stephen Lemons and was posted on October 30th. Earlier this year, journalists and politicians who have criticized Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell were the target of social media grousing and insults from a pair of anonymous accounts on X, the site formerly known as Twitter. Now, Thanks to testimony given in Maricopa County Superior Court last month, those accounts have been unmasked as belonging to Paul Stout, who confirmed under oath that he ran the burner accounts and is Mitchell's fiance. The revelation surfaced in September, as Stout took the stand to defend an August 22nd injunction he obtained against suspended attorney Vladimir Gajic, after a social media tiff between the two over Mitchell got too personal. The court sided with Stout and upheld the injunction. In the process, though, the 63-year-old former employee of the Arizona Department of Child Safety outed himself as a keyboard warrior who has angrily inserted himself into the mentions of reporters and politicos in Maricopa County. The two accounts in question, at AZJPaul and at AZ1Patriot, are now defunct. But in the course of his online feud with Stout, Gajic compiled files of posts from both accounts, many of which targeted critics and rivals of Mitchell. The at AZ1Patriot account took aim at Gina Godbehere, Mitchell's opponent in this year's Republican primary, calling Godbehere a, quote, pandering liar and a, quote, scared chicken, among other things. After Godbehere posted a Mother's Day message on X, the account accused her of exploiting Mother's Day and of wearing an overly too tight shirt, a comment Godbehere later referred to as a creepy response from her rival's romantic partner. The at AZ1Patriot account went after figures who endorsed Godbehere over Mitchell, including GOP congressional candidate Abraham Hamada and former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. At AZ1Patriot called Hamada Dishonest Abe and an election-denying crybaby whose political career is like a backed-up toilet. At AZ1Patriot also mocked Arpaio as Grumpy Joe and pointed out that the former sheriff had cost taxpayers in excess of $250 million, a reference to the Melendrez v. Arpaio lawsuit that has landed the sheriff's office under the scrutiny of a federal court for a decade. Ironically, Mitchell has criticized the outcome of the Melendrez case. Using both accounts, Stout also took swipes at local journalists. Arizona Republic columnist Lori Roberts and Republic criminal justice reporter Jimmy Jenkins drew his ire. So has Phoenix New Times, which AZ1Patriot labeled junk reporting, in response to a post by the paper's news editor, Zach Buchanan. AZ1AZPatriot also mentioned this reporter briefly in one post. The at AZJPaul account derided ABC 15 reporter Nicole Grigg as a fiction writer, and it blasted erstwhile Democratic county attorney candidate Julie Gunigal for her flaming radical liberal views, insisting that Gunigal isn't qualified to be the lowest level supervisor at the MCAO. New Times reached out to Stout directly via a phone number believed to be his, but Stout has not replied. A feud begins. Stout's online sniping might have remained undiscovered until he trolled Gajic, who posts frequently and sometimes maniacally on X. At the September 16th hearing on the injunction he filed against the 50-year-old Gajic, Stout admitted using the at AZJPaul account to start the feud with Gajic. It probably started at the end of 2023, and I had seen some very negative posts directed at Rachel Mitchell, my fiancé, and so I responded, Stout told the court. He claimed Mitchell never asked him to post on social media, and that he deleted the at AZJPaul account in late February of 2024. Mitchell had refused to confirm or deny Stout as her fiancé, but she acknowledged him by name after he held the Bible when she took her oath of office in 2022. She giddily thanked him for being a bedrock of security and support through the campaign, even attending fundraisers on her behalf. Stout has also contributed to Mitchell's re-election campaign, donating $350 so far. When Gojek criticized Mitchell for her office's controversial prosecution of Phoenix resident Jamal Pennington on accusations of sex trafficking and sexual contact with a minor, @AZJPaul lit into the attorney. Gojek had defended Pennington until the State Bar of Arizona went after Gojek for criticizing judges assigned to the case, suspending his law license for 1 year and fining him $6,000. @AZJPaul posted a link to Gojek's disciplinary history and called Gojek disgraced and delusional. In another post, @AZJPaul posted a YouTube video of Gojek being assaulted in court by Lamont Payne, whom Gojek was assigned to represent on behalf of Maricopa County Public Defense Services. Accused of biting a county corrections officer on the ankle, Payne had been ordered out of court by a judge for being disruptive when he unexpectedly sucker-punched Gojek in the head. The assault made national news. Can you explain why your client cold-cocked you in the courtroom? @AZJPaul asked Gojek in a back-and-forth on X. The @AZ1Patriot account remained active at least until a July 5th post, when the account denied being Stout and claimed to be a married female. Stout testified that he closed both accounts because he wanted to disengage from Gojek and that he misrepresented his identity in that July 5th post for the same reason. I didn't want to have any communication with you, Stout told Gojek under cross-examination, adding, if I had to do it over again, I would not have had any communication whatsoever with you. Trolling the wrong guy. Stout soon learned he'd trolled the wrong person. Gojek told Maricopa County Commissioner Richard Albrecht, who presided over the hearings, that someone dropped a dime to him that @AZJPaul was Stout. Gojek said he was floored and began investigating Stout and posting what he found out, or at least what he thought he'd found out. Gojek said he began posting about Stout because he believed Mitchell was retaliating against me by proxy, by using him to come after me, first as @AZJPaul and then as @AZ1Patriot. Gojek said that he believed Stout had been using other anonymous accounts, which Stout denied under oath. When an account he believed to be Stout addressed him directly, Gojek fired back writing, "Fine, Paul, name the place, Saturday." Stout testified that Gojek's challenge alarmed him and made him feel harassed, and it was one of several incidents mentioned in Stout's petition for an injunction against harassment. Gojek posted Stout's signature and court paperwork regarding Stout's child support. Gojek also dug up and posted a request for an injunction against harassment, filed against Stout by a neighbor in 2007. On YouTube, Gojek also posted audio from the hearing in which Stout successfully challenged the injunction, with the title, "Rachel Mitchell, Maricopa County Attorney Fiancé Paul Stout and His History of Violence." Gojek also posted court paperwork from Texas concerning a Paul M. Stout, who was convicted of a sex crime, either ignoring or unaware at the time that Stout's middle initial is H, and wondered, in a post, if Mitchell's fiancée had been convicted of a similar crime and if Mitchell was hiding this from the public. Even if not true, Gojek wrote, if RM can't control her creepy psycho fiancé, how can she run MCAO? Gojek told New Times that he didn't know the Texas Stout was a different person, but he was trying to find out if it was. I didn't say it was Rachel Mitchell's fiancé. I just said, is this the guy? He explained, adding, if I knew he was Paul H. Stout, I wouldn't have done it. Albrecht ruled against Gojek's argument that adding a question mark to some of the accusations absolved them of being accusations, finding that Gojek's posts on the subject were not entitled to the protection of the First Amendment. Stout filed the petition for an injunction in August, saying that he feared for his safety and reputation, and became withdrawn. Though the two men had never met in person before the hearings on the injunction, Stout nonetheless checked a box on the injunction form that instructed Gojek to stay away from Stout's residence and to not possess any firearms while the injunction is in effect. Stout said he checked the box because he knew Gojek was a former Marine and assumed he might have firearms. Stout also testified that Mitchell helped him draft the complaint against Gojek. A pre-hearing filing made by Stout's counsel listed Mitchell as a possible witness for Stout, but the county attorney was a no-show. Through county attorney spokesperson Janine LeCure, Mitchell declined to speak to New Times. However, LeCure said no county dollars have been expended on the matter. Injunction granted. The injunction was granted on August 22nd and ordered Gojek to have no contact with Stout, in person, electronic, digital, or through third parties. The injunction also instructed Gojek to cease posting or remove all social media posts consisting of lewd, obscene, or profane remarks, or personal attacks that do not convey a message that is of public interest. Gojek still may comment on ideas posted by Mr. Stout. Gojek challenged the injunction and represented himself at the hearing. Stout was represented by Christopher Rapp, Leslie Sorensen, and Andrew Pacheco of the Phoenix firm Ryan Rapp Pacheco and Sorensen. Notably, Pacheco is a former bureau chief with the county attorney's office and was once the chief of the criminal division of the Arizona Attorney General's office. The law firm is also listed as an approved vendor with Maricopa County, with a contract allowing the firm to charge anywhere from $150 to $340 per hour for legal fees. Rapp and Pacheco have donated to Mitchell's reelection campaign, each giving $500 apiece. Both men gave more to Mitchell during the 2022 cycle, when she was running in a special election to replace former county attorney Alistair Adele. Pacheco donated $1,500 to Mitchell that year, while Rapp donated $1,000. The firm declined a request for comment. Albrecht ultimately ruled against Gojek's effort to quash the injunction, claiming that it was content neutral and did not implicate his First Amendment rights. Albrecht's ruling makes no mention of Stout's claim to be Mitchell's fiancé. Gojek is appealing the decision. Meanwhile, he has seen some vindication in the case that caused the state bar to penalize him and for which Stout attacked him online. Though a judge in February sentenced former Gojek client Jamal Pennington to 30 years for sexual conduct with a minor, the Arizona Republic previously reported that the now adult female victim in the case says Pennington never touched her. Pennington's conviction is now before the Arizona Court of Appeals. In its response to Pennington's appeal, Arizona Attorney General Chris May's office conceded in a brief to the court that prosecutorial error occurred when the county attorney presented arguments that were factually incorrect. As a result, the May's office concluded that Pennington should receive a new trial for his sexual conduct with a minor charge. The appeals court has yet to rule, but Gojek is unconvinced that it will do the right thing in Pennington's case. Before that case, Gojek had been an attorney for 20 years with no prior history of discipline from the bar. He now believes the bar did Mitchell's bidding in sanctioning him, and that the injunction from Stout is another effort to shut him up. Gojek's suspension has ended, though he has not applied for reinstatement. He's fighting Stout's injunction for the same reason he popped off about the judges in Pennington's case. He wanted a fair day in court. "I'm not saying he's innocent," Gojek said of Pennington. "I'm just saying give him a chance to prove he's not guilty. Know what I mean?" Meet the Cat Ladies, tackling Phoenix's stray problem all by themselves. This next story is from the cover of this week's print edition of the New Times and was written by Morgan Fisher. It was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on October 28th. The sun was slowly setting one September evening in the Green Gables neighborhood of Central Phoenix as Wendy Morris popped the trunk of her silver PT Cruiser. One by one, she unloaded seven or eight long metal animal traps, the bottom each lined with newspaper. Over the next few hours, Morris hoped to fill those traps with cats. This is a near-nightly ritual for Morris. Clad in gray cargo shorts, a maroon cropped tank top, and Birkenstock sandals, she ventures out each evening, setting traps and waiting for stray cats to take the bait. The valley's urban landscape offers plenty of prey, too much really, but Morris isn't trolling neighborhoods like a small game hunter. She's here to save the cats from themselves. A United Healthcare analyst by day, Morris has dedicated herself to attacking Phoenix's stray cat problem. For two decades, she's roamed old neighborhoods, trailer parks, and business centers to keep the cat population from spiraling out of control. When a cat colony takes over a block, homeowners dial her number. Unlike a cat, Morris almost always comes when called. Morris is one of several intrepid individuals, most of them women, who take it upon themselves to rein in the city's stray cat population. They scour social media to find people in need of their services. Concerned residents track them down by word of mouth. When a cat colony balloons out of control, Morris and her counterparts are summoned like superheroes, ready to do what they can to stem the feline tide. These vigilantes are not grim reapers. Morris and others perform trap-neuter release. Morris's rear license plate reads SPAM, while a decorative plate on the front of her car reads TNR, which essentially is population control by way of abduction. Night after night, Morris and her compatriots will scoop up as many strays as possible, take them to a veterinarian to get them spayed or neutered, and then return them to the area in which they were found. Sterilize enough cats in a colony, and eventually, the colony dies out. These cat trappers don't get rich doing this. In many cases, they lose money. But they're in tremendously high demand. Morris's schedule is packed full of trapping jobs at least a month in advance. To put it mildly, Phoenix's stray cat problem is only getting worse. "We are absolutely in a cat crisis right now," said Missy Pruitt, the founder of the cat education group, the Arizona Advocats. "This has been the worst year for cats." Exact numbers are hard to nail down, but Pruitt guesses Maricopa County likely has about 500,000 to 1 million outdoor cats roaming its streets. In 2014, the Arizona Humane Society estimated that the county had only 250,000 outdoor cats. "The problem is biological. Cats just breed so efficiently," said Stephanie Nichols-Young, the executive director of the Animal Defense League of Arizona, which has helped spay and neuter 170,000 cats since 2009. "Cats can get pregnant when they're as young as 4 months old, and can deliver up to 4 litters per year, each consisting of 4 to 6 kittens. By the time a cat is 2.5 years old, it can have birthed as many as 48 kittens. The problem also is human," Pruitt and others say. "Too many people feed stray cats without bothering to get them fixed, resulting in more kittens and more cats in the colony. Unprepared pet owners abandon their kittens, unspayed and unneutered, putting more strays into the community. Eventually, the population crests to the point that Facebook and Nextdoor fill up with pleas for help. The cycle continues until, in a PT Cruiser with a SPAM license plate, help finally arrives. On a mission. On this particular night in Green Gables, Morris had a goal. She and Linda Duell, another volunteer cat trapper of 30 years, aimed to capture 2 kittens. Morris and Duell approached a home they'd visited just a week earlier. The first time, they'd successfully trapped 2 kittens, but the homeowner had released them while Morris tried to find the kittens a foster home. Now, the duo was trying again. This location posed a challenge. The cat colony, consisting of about 30 unsterilized animals, had taken up residence on the property of a man who feeds them. but the man was uninterested in cooperating with Morris to get the cat spayed or neutered. Unfortunately, this isn't uncommon. Some people harbor personal beliefs against fixing animals, feeling that doing so takes away a tomcat's manhood. Others don't want to shoulder the expense, or, because the cats belong to nobody, don't believe it's their responsibility. Without sterilization, Morris said, a cat colony can go from 30 animals to 100 very quickly. Few live pleasant lives. Kittens often die at birth or have complications. Alone on Phoenix's streets, these kittens are left unvaccinated, uncared for, and sick. They're targets for predators, such as coyotes. An indoor cat can live up to 20 years, but an outdoor cat may last only 2 or 3. People are the main culprits in this cat repopulation loop, Duell said. A homeowner may get a kitten for the family and everything's nice while the kitten is cute and little, until it grows up and the family doesn't want it anymore. It ends up outside, unfixed, and having babies, Duell said. That's the biggest cause of cat overpopulation. Cat colonies also can cause issues between neighbors. For every homeowner who is more than happy to feed all the kitties that come to the door, there are many more who can't stand the sight of another stray. It's often those residents who call trappers, such as Morris and Duell. The woman who summoned Morris to this home actually lived next door. An owner of 2 indoor cats, she was tired of finding cat poop and dead birds all over her property. Other Phoenix residents aren't so cat-friendly, the women say. Instead of calling a trapper, they shoot strays with BB guns or run them over. It helps to have a homeowner's cooperation, but trappers aren't always so fortunate. We've been made crazy cat ladies because we have to sneak into people's yards to feed a cat, Pruitt said. Or sneak onto an apartment complex to trap these cats that need TNR. This particular night, Morris Duell and fellow volunteer trapper Carolyn Lavender were given an ultimatum by the homeowner who'd been feeding the strays. If they wanted to trap cats, they had to stay off his property to do it. And if they wanted them hungry, too bad. At 8 p.m., he told the women, he'd be feeding the cats dinner. How to catch a cat. Morris Duell and Lavender huddled together, peering at a box trap from a distance. Slowly, a cat walked toward a cup of food placed in the far end of the trap. The cat entered the trap. Then, clang! A metal door snapped shut behind the animal, triggered by the addition of the cat's weight. Duell walked over, placed a blanket over the trap, and peered into the trap to examine the cat's ears. They were unclipped. Strays, who have been fixed and released as part of a TNR program, have clipped ears. So Duell quickly moved the trap toward Morris's car as the cat howled and scratched. One down. Food is a motivator when trapping strays, which is why it's tough to catch cats when someone has been feeding the colony. Full cats won't go in the traps, but hungry cats will. When homeowners are cooperative, Morris and others tell them to stop feeding colonies for 24 hours before the traps are set. The box traps don't always work, though, and the women eventually changed tactics. They turned to a drop trap. This device is simple. It's essentially a box propped up on one end by a stick with a string tied to it. It's also expensive. A single drop trap costs between $100 and $130, which these women pay for out of their own pockets. A second cat soon ventured over to sniff at an offering of food. Morris pulled the rope, yanking out the box of support, and dropping the trap over the cat. Rushing over, the women placed their weight on the drop trap, hoping to avoid a flailing claw to the ankle. Duell brought over a smaller cage called a transfer trap, placing it near an opening in the first trap, and beckoning the cat into the new trap with a flashlight. Two down. Soon, the trio had snagged a third, raising a dilemma. The neighbor who'd contacted Morris had agreed to pay for only 3 cats to be spayed or neutered. But there was still time on the clock, and three cats barely make a dent in a colony of 30. The women all had the same question. Should they go for more? Getting a cat fixed isn't cheap. It costs between $45 to $80 to get the procedure done in the Valley, which is an increase from approximately $25 just a couple of years ago. I can't tell you the amount of money I've spent on my own, Morris said. Battling the wind and illuminated by a full moon glowing behind them, Morris and Lavender both said that they'd pay for one more, committing $45 each. You're going to be broke like I am, joked the 71-year-old Jewel, who ended her retirement due to the cost of cat trapping. I used to pay for it for myself out of pocket, but it's gotten so expensive, and I just can't afford to do it. A lack of resources. In the world of cat trapping, high costs and a lack of resources are a constant problem. As Phoenix's feline population increases, and as its population control relies more heavily on unpaid volunteers, cat trappers find themselves burned out, unsupported, and financially unstable. The drain of resources caused in part by COVID-19 also impacts area veterinarians. There are less clinics now than there were, said Bob the Catman Snow, an 89-year-old former trapper who now coordinates cat foster homes in the Valley. There's less opportunity for people to get trapped cats spay-neutered than there used to be. Nonprofits such as the volunteer-run ADLA try to help. Since the early 90s, the ADLA has connected trappers and homeowners through its spay-neuter hotline, although it now prefers that residents contact its office using an online form. Whether by phone or online, ADLA provides homeowners with traps, connects them with volunteers, and sets up vet appointments, which cost a recommended donation of $25 to $45 per cat. Yet, since the pandemic, ADLA also has felt the strain of diminishing resources. The organization used to coordinate the spaying and neutering of 10,000 cats a year, but that number has decreased to 8,000 cats. Trappers are hoping for city support. Earlier this month, Dual formed a group that plans to request $1 million in funding from the Phoenix City Council to support TNR training, to help fund spay and neuter clinics, and to pay veterinarians. If we don't do it soon, it's going to need to be $3 million, Dual said. Pruitt, who focuses on cat education, has also sought city support. She's used her 3 minutes of public comment time several times during council meetings to talk about Phoenix's cat problem and ask for education funding. City Council spokesperson Adam Walls said the council does not have an ordinance regarding stray cats, nor does it provide funding for population control. Maricopa County Animal Control and Care doesn't do much either. MCACC cannot pick up stray or feral cats or address those feeding cats in their neighborhood, according to its website. Instead, the agency directs residents to ADLA's spay-neuter hotline and the Arizona Humane Society. Other Phoenix communities have relied on donations to fund their own TNR programs. Grand Canyon University has a club called TNR for GCU, whose members trap, neuter, and release the cats that reside in colonies on the university's campus. In August, the club started a change.org petition that received more than 1,000 signatures to protest what it claimed was the university's proposed plan to deprive the cats of food and water in an effort to eliminate pigeons, which eat food left out for the cats. The petition is now closed. Club president Chris Walker said that there was a miscommunication on the school's part and that GCU doesn't plan on hindering our operations as long as we comply with the rules they have for us. GCU did not respond to a request for comment. In downtown Phoenix's Garfield District, the neighborhood organization has formed a committee dubbed the Garfield TNR Cat Wranglers to help combat the feral cat population there. The group has received $1,000 in donations, which has gone toward the TNR of about 20 cats in the neighborhood, said resident Raleigh Dombeck. Those efforts are great, but they're hardly enough. Right now, all we're doing is putting a Band-Aid on it, Pruitt said. It's not just these crazy cat ladies' problem. It's the whole community's issue. Never done. By around 9 p.m. at the Green Gables cat colony, the cat trapping is over. Morris, Duell, and Lavender have captured 7 cats, 2 of which Morris believes to be the same kittens that were caught and released the first time around. Inside the next-door neighbor's home, the trio transferred the 2 kittens into crates to be moved. If a kitten is trapped and is young enough, it has a chance to make it into Arizona's adoption system. It will be taken to a home where its foster parents will attempt to socialize it until it's big enough to be vaccinated and put up for adoption. The 2 kittens trapped by the trio went home with Lavender, who named them Doris and Elliot. She currently is fostering them and will transfer them to the Arizona Animal Welfare League for adoption once they are socialized. The adult cats were taken to appointments through the ADLA to get spayed and neutered. Then, they're returned to their colony. Morris, Duell, and Lavender will be back, too. Their mission will never end. There will always be more kittens than they can capture and sterilize. There will never be enough money or support to control the cat population for good. That doesn't deter the women, or the many others like them across the valley. Even though they're stuck in a Groundhog Day-like loop, trap cats, neuter cats, lose money, they cruise Phoenix neighborhoods with their car trunks full of cages, looking for the glint of cat eyes in the dark. If they don't do it, they know nobody else will. Next, a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on November 1st. Is Mark Brnovich gearing up to sue Stephen Richer for defamation? Last year, Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Richer blasted former Republican Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich in an interview, claiming Brnovich used his office to persecute county election workers. Now, according to court records, Brnovich is taking legal steps that might presage a defamation lawsuit against Richer. On October 9th, an attorney for Brnovich sued Richer's office to demand a variety of public records related to comments Richer made in an interview with a Bloomberg News reporter in November of 2023. The recorder's office has since completed that record request, turning over more than 3,000 pages of documents, and the lawsuit has been withdrawn. But questions loom. What will Brnovich do next? Is Richer, a Republican who has defended the county and state against election conspiracy theories and who lost his primary election to an election skeptic, about to be hit with a defamation suit? Media law experts and First Amendment attorneys contacted by New Times think that's possible. Greg Leslie, the executive director of the First Amendment Clinic at Arizona State University's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law, said it could lead to a defamation suit. First Amendment scholar and retired media law professor Joe Russomano agreed. I can't read his mind, but it seems entirely possible, Russomano said. It would make sense to speculate that that is a very possible next step, that the reason he wants those records is to see exactly what Richer said, and very possibly then proceed from there. Brnovich seemingly has not yet decided on that next step. Phoenix New Times emailed attorney Dennis Willenchink, who represented Brnovich in the public records case, to ask if a defamation suit is in the offing. We'll let you know, Willenchink replied. What's this all about? The bad blood between the two prominent Republicans goes back at least 2 years. In April 2022, Brnovich released a widely derided interim report about potential fraud in the 2020 election. The report criticized the county for being uncooperative and claimed to identify issues with voter signature verification, ballot handling, and the use of private grant money to fund the election. At the time, Brnovich was playing out his last few months in office while mounting a run for the U.S. Senate, ultimately losing to Blake Masters in the Republican primary. In a joint letter to Brnovich that was made public, Richer and the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors excoriated the Attorney General for his interim report's failings and misrepresentations. According to the letter, the report spread misinformation and seeded doubt, which has led to renewed threats and harassment of county election staff. It told Brnovich that he omitted pertinent information, misrepresented facts, and cited distorted data to seed doubt about the conduct of elections in Maricopa County, and that the 2020 election was fair and the results indisputable. The letter was particularly pointed. It accused Brnovich of issuing his report to, quote, score cheap political points, and criticized one of the report's assertions as intellectually insulting to anyone who has taken the LSAT, presumably you. We should not have to remind you of your oaths, yet here we are, the letter concluded. You are not just an ordinary politician. You are the state's top prosecutor, and you are held to a different standard. A month after Brnovich left office in early 2023, new Democratic Attorney General Chris Mays released documents showing that Brnovich's investigators did not uncover any criminality or fraud in the 2020 election. As a result, several complaints against Brnovich were filed with the Arizona State Bar. According to State Bar spokesperson Joe Hengemuller, those complaints are now closed and have no public disposition. The specter of those complaints followed Brnovich to a new position at his current law firm, Boies Schiller Flexner, prompting Bloomberg News reporter Justin Wise to interview Richer about the ethics probe. In the article, Richer said Brnovich could have used his position as top prosecutor of the state to set the record straight that Arizona's November 2020 election wasn't stolen. Instead, Wise wrote, periodically quoting Richer, Brnovich used his office to persecute election workers for political purposes, and that's disgusting. 6 months later, Brnovich filed his records request with Richer's office. What's in these records? Brnovich's records request, reproduced in his lawsuit against the recorder's office, was long and detailed. It demanded the source of Richer's comments on Brnovich using his office to persecute election workers for political purposes, and statements made to the media about Brnovich's role in Arizona's 2020 election. Brnovich also requested evidence of threats made, vile emails received by, and emotional breakdowns experienced by election workers because of and related to Brnovich's actions. The request sat unfilled for months, leading to Brnovich's public records suit. Taylor Kinnerup, spokesperson for the Maricopa County Recorder's Office, said the delay was the result of the office switching to a new system after receiving an unprecedented volume of records requests and subpoenas since 2020. The request was fulfilled in mid-October. New Times also acquired the records provided to Brnovich, most of which contain emails, media interactions, and internal documents, as well as election-related threats. Included is a 2022 email in which Maricopa County Communications Director Fields Mosley states that the interim report doesn't accuse election workers or Maricopa County of fraud. But few of the records relate directly to Brnovich or even mention him at all. The records do include a flurry of email threats against Richer and other election officials, including Secretary of State Adrian Fontes and Supervisor Bill Gates. Other documents sent to Brnovich include a letter between the Assistant Attorney General and the Election Department, signature verification information for voting, everyday internal emails frequent communications with media organizations, and several editions of the Arizona Capital Times Yellow Sheet Report and Arizona Agenda newsletters. There are some juicy election-related emails among the records, but they pertain to other Arizona politicians. Using his personal email, Richard sent messages to county staff criticizing election lawsuits filed after the 2022 election by four Republicans, Attorney General candidate Abe Hamada, Secretary of State candidate Mark Fincham, State Senator Sonny Borelli, and gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake. Richard wrote that the lawsuits by Fincham, Borelli, and Lake were insane, are written with the legal clarity of a pro se criminal defendant with access to the prison's law library, and might as well be written in pencil and paper. The suit from Hamada, who lost his race to Mays by 280 votes, was the only one that looks like a real contest. However, Richard wrote he doubted it would succeed, calling it comically simple and bare bones. All four lawsuits failed, though Lake and Hamada are still pushing theirs, despite running for new positions this election. What's next? Whether or not Brnovich pursues a defamation case largely hinges on whether those records provided him with ammunition. Wilenchik did not respond to questions asking if he had found anything problematic in the records. In the public records suit against Richard's office, Wilenchik wrote that Richard's comments to Bloomberg had hurt Brnovich's reputation and standing in the community, and affected his future employment opportunities and/or political aspirations. If Brnovich does file a defamation suit, it may be an uphill battle. To prove defamation, a public figure such as Brnovich must demonstrate the defendant acted with a reckless disregard for the truth and was beyond negligent. Brnovich's lawyers would have to prove that Richard was lying and that he knew he was lying. According to Leslie at ASU, that's a difficult thing to maintain in a libel suit. Leslie said that while it's unusual for a former public official to sue another public official for defamation, it's getting more common. In fact, it's not new at all to Richard or Brnovich's lawyer. In June of 2023, Richard sued Lake for defamation after she accused him of sabotaging her failed bid for governor in 2022. This March, Lake's lawyers stopped defending the suit and requested a default judgment. By giving up, Lake legally admitted that she defamed Richard, though she has continued to claim the opposite publicly. The two sides are now squabbling over damages, with Wilenchik representing Lake. Now, depending on what Brnovich decides to do, Richard could go from being a plaintiff in a defamation case to being a defendant. If he's worried, he's not saying. New Times asked Richard's office if Richard was concerned about Brnovich's intentions. Kinnerup did not directly respond, only reiterating that the office completed its statutory obligation to fulfill records requests. As we near the end of this week's program, here's a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on November 1st. How a Phoenix woman found herself speaking to 75,000 Harris supporters. Jenny Poon could feel her daughter holding her legs as they shook. Standing on an elevated blue stage at the Ellipse in front of the White House in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, the 41-year-old Poon focused on keeping her voice steady. "Don't fall, don't fall, don't fall," she kept thinking as her hands trembled. Surrounded by her husband and their two children, the Phoenix small business owner spoke to 75,000 attendees of Vice President Kamala Harris's closing argument of her presidential campaign. A day earlier, Poon had no idea she'd even be there. On Monday morning, Poon was in her Phoenix home reading her emails. As far as she was aware, her brush with the political spotlight had already happened. She'd been featured in an ad for what was then the Biden-Harris campaign. But about 7:30 that morning, that ad led to a phone call. It was a campaign staffer asking Poon if she'd come to D.C. They wanted her to speak at Harris's rally the next day. "How do you say no to that?" Poon told New Times. "How can I say no to being there in this monumental moment where we are about to elect our very first woman and person of color as president?" Only 3 hours later, she pulled her daughter from school, threw clothes into a bag, and with her husband and two kids, was on her way to Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport to catch a flight across the country. They arrived in the nation's capital at 11 p.m. that night. By the next evening, Poon was speaking to a massive crowd. Poon cut through the nervousness with humor, introducing her young children to the crowd. "This is Ida and Oaken," she said. "I don't think they've ever seen this many people in their entire lives." Even she had little idea of how many people there really were. Leading up to the event, she was expecting roughly 20,000 attendees. She'd heard rumors that the crowd could reach up to 50,000 people, but she wound up speaking to 75,000. For perspective, the largest sports venue in Arizona, State Farm Stadium, holds only 63,000. "I'm really glad I didn't know that it was 75,000 when I went out there," Poon said. Who runs the world? Representing Arizona, business entrepreneurs, and families at the rally, Poon spoke about the increasing cost of living, price gouging, reproductive rights, and small business ownership. "Today, women run our homes, they run our businesses, they run our cities, and soon they'll run this country," she told attendees, who responded with cheers and chants of "USA, USA." After she was laid off from her art director job at the Arizona Republic during the 2008 recession, Poon started her own marketing business. In 2010, she and her husband, former Republic sports writer Odin Domingo, founded Phoenix's first co-working space, Cohoots. Almost 10 years later, she expanded, founding the entrepreneur support platform HUUB. Assuming there are no more speeches for her to give, all Poon has to do now is wait for election results. "I'm pretty sure I'm going to cry regardless, either tears of grief or tears of happiness," she said. "I'm really hoping it's happiness, because it will be historic." And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hoprock. Remember that if you missed any of the stories in this program or any other Sun Sounds programs, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then click on Demand Podcasts, scroll down to the program you're interested in, and click on Listen.